Welcome back, Question Madison. 2019, this is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. You know what time it is. When you hear my voice, it can only mean one thing. It can only mean one thing. And that, of course, is I'm singing in the shower, or it's time for another podcast. It's time to dig in what I'm digging on. It's time to get into the articles that I'm talking about, reading about, and thinking about. It is that time once again. So, without any further ado, without any hesitation, reservation, it is good to be back. Here we go. As I said in the intro, Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. This is Question Madison 2019, meant to challenge your brain, stimulate the clitoris of your neuronal connections. That's right. Let's jump into this. The first article is something that I think is oh so important. There is one thing in medicine that seems to always be true, and that is that too much of a good thing is a bad thing, and too much of a bad thing is... it's still a bad thing, actually. There's no good in that. But that is no more clearly seen than in this study in the Journal of Endocrinology and Metabolism, June 1st, 2019, titled Proximal A1C Levels and the Hypoglycemia Hospitalization in Adults with Type 2 Diabetes. This looked at just about 300 patients in the UK with type 2 diabetes. And it looked at their first event or their event for hospitalization for severe hypoglycemia. And then they looked at what was the A1C level in the previous 90 days. See, we would think that a hemoglobin A1C that was maybe really low because these people were really trying to get their A1Cs down, that would mean that you were more likely to be hospitalized because of a hypoglycemic event. Or to swing it the other way, maybe the individuals that have really high A1C levels were trying to get their A1C down. They were trying to do good, doc. They were trying to take their insulin, and then they were hospitalized because of a hypoglycemic event. No matter which way you think it occurred, you're correct. Because compared with a hemoglobin A1C level of 7%, a 6% and a 9%, so a lower and a higher, conferred equal excess risk of hypoglycemic events that required hospitalization. This is odds ratio of 1.5. And no, this was not a randomized control trial, because we can never do randomized control trials to say, hey, we're going to have you keep your A1C level really low and yours really high, and we're going to see which one of you goes into the hospital first with a hypoglycemic event. That just doesn't exist. But when you do observational study, there needs to be plausible reason for it. There needs to almost also be a dose effect. If you give more medication, you should see a higher dose. Well, what I like about this is that when you looked at the hemoglobin A1C between 4% and 6.5%, the lower the A1C, the higher the risk for hypoglycemia. And when you looked at the percentage between 8 and 11.5%, again, the higher the A1C, the higher the risk for hospitalization secondary to hypoglycemia. I think this just speaks clear that some is good, but a lot is bad, and almost very little is also bad. On to the next article. Here we go. They say some things are good, some things are bad, and some things are just to be expected. That is so clearly seen in this article in JAMA Internal Medicine titled Use of Directly Observed Therapy to Assess Treatment Adherence in Patients with Apparent Treatment-Resistant Hypertension. This took place in Canada. They had 48 patients who had treatment-resistant hypertension. When they did ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, the quote-unquote gold standard, these patients, despite being on three antihypertensive medications, still had systolic blood pressures greater than 135. So what do? Instead of adding another medication, they actually had the patients be observed taking their medication for one day by a nurse. All they had to do was they were watched take their medication for one day. And then 24 hours later, they did another ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, and then they did the same thing 1 month later. Now, I don't really care if your blood pressure is in range 24 hours after I have a nurse watch you take your medications, because that doesn't really reflect my patient population. That doesn't give me anything to work with, because I'm not going to have my patients having their blood pressures, or their blood pressure medication, I guess I should say, watched or monitored by a nurse to make sure that they're taking it. However, by doing this, in these almost 50 individuals, 30% of those individuals at 1 month when they had their ambulatory blood pressure monitoring were all of a sudden, magically, wouldn't you know it, had a systolic blood pressure in range. They had a decrease in the overall systolic blood pressure by, on average, 26 millimeters of mercury. One-third of the patients were, quote-unquote, cured of their hypertension. I think this is huge because it just goes to show that one-third of the patients were lying. And I shouldn't say lying because some are good, some are bad, and some are to be expected. And we can just expect that sometimes patients tell us what we want to hear. Sometimes patients will come out of their mouth and say, oh yeah, doc, don't worry, I'm doing it. But you know they're really not doing it. I think the key here is, how do we cut through that doctor-patient relationship, cut the crap, if you will, get to the bottom line and say, but be honest, are you really doing it? Because adding another medication and adding another medication and adding another medication will do nothing if the patient is not taking the medication. A couple episodes ago, I talked quite highly about proton pump inhibitors. And then there was a new study out maybe a few days after I actually published or posted that one, and this was in the BMJ. It was a VA, a Veteran Affairs study, if you will, and it was titled Estimates of All-Cause Mortality and Cause-Specific Mortality Associated with Proton Pump Inhibitors Among U.S. Veterans. The beautiful thing about the U.S. veterans is that we have a whole bunch of data on them, and sometimes we can just mine that data for whatever we want. In this study, they had participants, almost 150,000 new users of proton pump inhibitors, and then they had 57,000 new users of H2 blockers. They try to minimize confounding as much as possible. What does that mean? There are new listeners, so let me just kind of break it down. They try to say, for example, if you have diabetes, you're at this risk. If you have a smoker, you're at this risk. Often what gets missed is that diabetes, again, is not diabetes. An A1C of 9.9 is not the same as an A1C of, 7.3. A person that smokes 3 cigarettes a day is not the same as someone who smokes 3 packs of cigarettes a day. So even though they try to calculate all that out and they try to just make it as straight up as possible, what is just the effect of the PPI, you can never actually calculate out all of those confounding variables. In the end, after 10 years of follow-up, there was an extra 45 deaths per 1,000 PPI users compared to the H2 blockers. What does this mean going forward? It means that we should be careful when we prescribe the medication. Yes, of course we should. And if we weren't doing that before, well, here's a good wake-up call for you. We should not just hand out PPIs all the time. Am I handing out PPIs all the time? Absolutely not. Is it a wonderful drug that works really well and super fast when you need it? Absolutely. If you have a patient that says, hey, listen, I only get heartburn or indigestion when I eat chicken wings, then by all means, give them the medication. And as I've talked about before, the trials for proton pump inhibitors were never meant to be lifelong. That was not how it was intended to be. 6, 10, 12 weeks at most. And then you're off the medication. That was how it was intended. So start weaning the patients. They do have incredibly high rebound effects. So if you're going to wean it in a half dose, and then every other day, try to get them off the medication slowly, not fast. Don't stop it right away. But again, the best way is to not prescribe for proton pump inhibitors. However, if you're going to prescribe for it, then you probably have a good reason. And if you do, that's okay with me. One of the reasons that they think that proton pump inhibitors have this increase in mortality is the plausibility that proton pump inhibitors decrease acid. Cells use acid to kill bacteria and other cells or other viruses or other malfunctioning cells. And so when you decrease that ability to produce acid, you do it everywhere. I don't know if that's true or not. It makes sense in my head. I don't know if it's true. And it doesn't really matter as long as we're prescribing it with cautious reasons, prescribing it with a point, not just prescribing it because, oh, hey, I don't really know what to do, so here's a pill. And while you should certainly be trying to stop the proton pump inhibitors, there is also something else you should try to stop, and that is, of course, smoking. As shown in this study in cancer prevalence I know that's a very common journal that everyone reads, but smoking cessation and risk of bladder cancer among postmenopausal women. Here we go. This is the Women's Health Initiative. It has given us so much data. We're looking at almost 150,000 women aged 50 to 79 years old, and then they looked at, are you a never smoker, a former smoker, or a current smoker? In total, after 15 years of follow-up, there was almost 900 diagnosed bladder cancers. Of those, you were significantly more likely to have bladder cancer or be diagnosed with bladder cancer if you were a current smoker. Hazard ratio 3.4 compared to those who were never smokers. And if you were a former smoker, well, hazard ratio of 2.0. The nice thing here is, as I mentioned earlier, anytime you have observational data, everything has to make sense. So if you're giving more drug, you would expect to see more of an effect. If you're taking away smoking and you're tying smoking to bladder cancer, you would suspect that the longer you don't smoke, the less likely you are to be diagnosed with bladder cancer. And that was certainly shown in this. If you had quit smoking just within the last 10 years, you still had a pretty significant risk. But if you move that time frame out 10 to 20 years, there was a significantly lower risk than those that were less than 10. And those individuals who had quit smoking 20 to 30 years ago had even lower risk than those individuals that had only quit smoking 10 to 20 years ago. You see, as you get further away, it makes sense that you should then have a less likelihood or a lower probability of being diagnosed with bladder cancer. This is probably real, this is probably accurate, and this is just another reason to convince your patients to stop smoking. I've said it once, I'll say it again, and I'll probably say it again in the future, but if you're going to be really on point with how you do your medicine, you should probably take every single minute of every single visit with every single smoker that you have and just convince them to quit smoking. That alone will do more good than any cancer screening, any ultrasound, to anything else that we do, any blood tests. If you can, you will save more lives in general as a whole if we could just get more people to quit smoking. And speaking of quitting smoking and quitting other things, of course, I am talking about quitting just prescribing albuterol alone for your mild asthmatic. And you might be saying, what? Wait, huh? No albuterol? No PRN albuterol anymore? Nope, not happening. And Joe and I are podcasting about it right there on MRAP, the new guidelines that just come out. But let me tell you, their times are a-changing. No more, ever, never, 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 not once, just PRN albuterol for mild asthmatic patients. It is mainly based on this study in the New England Journal of Medicine, control trial of budesonide formoterol as needed for mild asthma. This study took 670 patients and they randomized them to one of three groups. You were either in the budesonide formoterol group, you were in the twice daily budesonide group plus an as needed albuterol, that was group number two, or just straight up as needed albuterol. They looked at rates of asthma exacerbation and wouldn't you know it, the inhaled corticosteroid slash LABA, the budesonide formoterol, and the inhaled corticosteroid were exactly the same, or at least statistically speaking, exactly the same, but both when compared to albuterol alone, PRN, albuterol alone, which is what we currently do, many of us, there were more exacerbations with the PRN albuterol. Now, an exacerbation was defined as 3 days, at least 3 days, of systemic steroids, and there were fewer severe exacerbations that occurred in the inhaled corticosteroid slash LABA group than in the inhaled corticosteroid alone. However, patients in the inhaled corticosteroid group had better daily symptom scores. So what do we make of this? Well, I could tell you what these new guidelines say, but I'm not going to quite yet. Here is what I can say. Budesonide formoterol, as needed, PRN, as needed, might as well go ahead and take the cake over any new scripts that you're ever going to write ever again for albuterol, PRN, as needed. So if you see yourself getting ready to write for albuterol, inhaler, PRN, no. You should be writing for budesonide formoterol, aka Symbicort. Symbicort, that's what you should be writing for, PRN, game changer, I'm telling you. Or inhaled corticosteroid every single day. But we know that patients don't take their medications every single day. This has been shown over and over again, like blood pressure medications just earlier during this podcast, or especially COPD, asthma, they just don't take it. Because if you're not having a hard time breathing, you doesn't bother you at all. It's not a pill that you have to take with the rest of your pills every day. It's an actual inhaler, and many people just do not take it, which is why the placebo rates are so high in many trials, because if you're comparing inhaler to a placebo inhaler, and the person's only taking the normal inhaler 50, 20, 30% of the time, well, then they're pretty much already taking placebo. So there it is. There you have it. This is game-changing. I promise you this is guideline-changing. I promise you there has not been a major change in asthma guidelines in decades. And I'm not exaggerating when I say decades. So I'm going to end with that because I think that is actually the key take-home piece that I want everyone to remember. And you remember the beginning, you remember the end, you kind of forget the middle. Let's end it on something I want you to remember. There we go. Let's wrap this one up like we have wrapped up every one before it. So in 30 seconds or less, let's bring it all together and summarize it one at a time. An A1C level low is not good, and a high A1C level is not low. Why? Because both of them seem to end up having you, the patient, in a hospital for a hypoglycemic event. The low point of this U-shaped curve seems to be around 7 to 8%, which ironically fits perfect with recent guidelines and evidence that we've had going on for quite some time now. But if that didn't come as a surprise, maybe this one will. Patients don't take the medications and sometimes are non-compliant. And they are non-compliant with their hypertensive medication. In this Canadian study, about one-third of the patients were quote-unquote magically cured when they were monitored and taking their hypertensive medication. And I say quote-unquote because I am quoting that they're magically cured. Speaking of magic, a proton pump inhibitor is not a magic drug, but let me tell you, it does work really, really well. But it's still a drug, and it still has real side effects, like death. So we shouldn't be giving these out to patients like candy, but if they need it, make no mistake about it, it works really well. We just shouldn't give it out to everyone for every little cause, because there does seem to be an increase in all-cause mortality. And speaking of really bad things like death, dying, and cancer, smoking seems to put you at a risk of bladder cancer. How much of a risk? Well, it depends on how long you've smoked for and when you quit smoking, but it seems to put you at about a 2 to 3 times increased risk. For me, that's not worth it, and I never really liked peeing blood, so I choose not to smoke. And last but not least, the article that you need to know about, the one that you need to take home with you, put it in your back pocket, and that is no more PRN, no more as-needed albuterol for mild asthma. Instead, when you want to write for PRN albuterol inhaler, you will instead write for a daily inhaled corticosteroid or PRN Symbicort or PRN inhaled corticosteroid / LABA. This is game-changing. This is mind-blowing. This is it. I would now like to end this podcast with a moment of silence for PRN albuterol in mild asthma. It is dead. All right, enough of that. Now let's wait for the music and close this one out. All right, here we go. So until next time, keep the quest in question.